hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my co-host, Dr. Pettis Perry. Hey, Pettis, how are you?
I'm doing okay, Jill. How are you today?
I got a scratchy throat and burning eyes with all the wildfire smoke in the area. Have you been suffering from any of the smoke up there in Bellingham from the Dixie Fire?
Yeah, we have. We've had about a week of it. Today was the first day that it's clear. And it's the only day I haven't been outside.
Oh, no. There must be a cousin to Murphy's Law about that.
I think so.
One clear day and you're inside. So as you know, Pettis, Be Bold America adds a new regular feature today. We're honored that KSQD was approved by Jim Hightower to play his commentaries. So for those who don't know, Jim Hightower is a Texan who is called America's most popular populist. And he is a best-selling author, public speaker, and political spark plug who has long chronicled ongoing democratic struggles by America's ordinary people. His two-minute commentaries are poignant and colorful, and we will play our first one today halfway through the show. And speaking of the show, do you want to introduce our topic?
I'd love to. Thank you. Our program today is The Web of Meaning. Who am I? Why am I? How should I live? These are some of the oldest questions humans have grappled with. In our modern high-tech society, we seem to have the answers. After all, hasn't science demonstrated that the humans are hardwired for selfishness, that we do our best when left alone to pursue our individual goals? Our guest today answers with a resounding no, not because he doesn't like these conclusions, but because the latest science shows them to be false. Jeremy Lentz's groundbreaking new book, The Web of Meaning, Integrating Science and Traditional Wisdom to Find Our Place in the Universe, weaves together the latest scientific findings with age-old philosophical insights to show how some of our most ingrained beliefs about human nature and the world are mistaken, and offers a powerful alternative to help us heal the planet. Our future depends on it. Jill, over to you to introduce our guest.
Okay, thank you. It's my honor. Our bold guest today is award-winning author Jeremy Lent. Jeremy was described by Guardian journalist George Monbiot as one of the greatest thinkers of our age. Jeremy is an author and speaker whose work investigates the underlying causes of our civilization's existential crisis and explores pathways toward a life-affirming future. Born in London, England, Jeremy received a BA in English Literature from Cambridge University, an MBA from the University of Chicago, and was a former internet company CEO. He is founder of the nonprofit Leology Institute that is dedicated to fostering an integrated worldview that could enable humanity to thrive sustainably on the earth. We have big things to do. Welcome back to Be Bold America, Jamie.
Well, thank you so much, Jill. It's such a pleasure to be on your show again. Thank you, Pettis, for the introduction, too.
Yes, well, I wanted to introduce you to Pettis because I don't think he was co-hosting when you were last on. Am I right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's the first I've gotten to connect with you, Pettis.
Thank you, Jeremy. I'm looking forward to our discussion today. You have a brilliant mind.
Oh, thank you.
Ditto that. Reading his book, you can't be left with anything else to know that Jeremy is just brilliant. And I guess to just get right into the intense conversation we'll be having, Jeremy, what does the web of meaning mean? And how do we live its principles when our country is completely tangled in a web of lies?
Yeah, it's such a truth there and such a key thing to think about right from the outset. So really what the web of meaning is this complex, unbelievably rich set of interconnections between us, even within ourselves, with all of humanity and with all of the whole living earth that we're all embedded in, whether we even know it or not. And it's really what the book explores is how the recognition of that connectivity all, with everything all around us in that network is what actually gives us meaning. That's where meaning actually arises in our lives.
Wow. Well, so you also talk about our current dominant worldview. Is it flawed?
It is fundamentally flawed. And that is really one of the big themes of the book is, you know, the thing about a worldview itself is that most people aren't even aware that they even have a worldview. You know, it's a little bit like when you're a fish swimming in water. And if you're outside of it, you look at the fish, you know they're in water. But as far as they're concerned, that's just what reality is. And similarly, most of us kind of live our lives assuming that the things we hear that we take for granted as just reality, this is the truth, obviously is that. And a lot of my work, not just in this book, The Web of Meaning, but in the last book that we talked about on your show, The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning, in all this work, I looked at the way in which different cultures actually have different worldviews. They make sense of the world in different ways. And I, along with most of us, for many, many years of my life, I just assumed that our modern worldview at least was clearly scientifically valid. Like, that's what science says is the way things are. That, you know, humans are just intrinsically selfish, or that nature is selfish, or that nature is just the kind of resource to be used. And oftentimes, we don't actually say these statements explicitly, but we just, they're implied in everything we do and say and think. And what my research then began to uncover is that not only are those assumptions leading our entire civilization potentially to catastrophe, but they're actually wrong. In fact, what science in the last few decades has shown us is that the opposite of all of those statements I just said are what is actually scientifically verifiably true, which just so happens to be what some of the great wisdom traditions of the past have been talking about for millennia.
Pettis, I know you have a question for Jeremy.
I've got lots of questions for Jeremy today.
So do I. We're going to have to compete for them.
Jeremy, let me start off with going a little bit deeper. Can you talk to us about the connection between humanity and the natural world?
Yeah, sure. That's one of the most important themes in the book, actually. And, you know, again, if we kind of look at where we sort of start from in how we usually make sense of things, most of us really think of nature as being something separate from humans. And it's not really surprising because that's what we've been told now for hundreds of years. You can actually go back all the way to Descartes, all the way back in the 17th century when he came up with this famous statement, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, which led to this notion that it's that human capacity for thinking in our unique way and our symbolic way of understanding things and language and all that stuff, that's what is our true identity. And so even our bodies aren't really us. And then the rest of the living earth doesn't really have an identity in itself. It's just kind of there, in fact, like a machine. And so we sort of, there's this metaphor of nature as a machine that we mostly take for granted. And what evolutionary biologists now show is that actually we're deeply, deeply connected with all of life. Life first arose on this earth about 4 billion years ago, and it evolved all these different incredibly rich ways to live in and fill out the ecosystems and do, like, add this abundance to everything around us on earth. And it did that by coming up with genes and ways of expressing those genes and then passing it on to other generations. And it turns out that actually just something like a fruit fly that we think of as utterly different from us shares about 40, actually the majority of its genes with humans. And here's the statistic that I love the most. A banana shares 44% of its genes with humans. Like, so we're deeply embedded in our deep connection with all of life, which is something that indigenous traditions always said. You know, many of them talk about all our relatives, like the Lakota tribe in North America has this phrase, Mitakuye Oyesin, which means all our relations, which it talks about not just other humans, but all of life. And that's one of the things that we, when we begin to to realize that, it changes the way that we perceive how to think about the rest of nature out there.
Now, can
it certainly does.
I want to add, just follow up on that, on Pettis's question. You also talk about the intelligence in the natural world, and nature isn't a machine. Then what is it? You know, what is that natural intelligence? And also, you talk about the ideology of human supremacy. Can you answer those?
Yeah. And so this notion of natural intelligence, that's another of these big misconceptions that has been actually really deeply embedded in science, even up to more recent times. And even right now, there's only some leading animal experts, ethologists, are beginning to kind of overturn this deep prejudice, which is this idea that only humans have real, like, intelligence, and that the rest of, when we see other animals doing things that seem intelligent or seem like they're intentional or that they care about what they're doing, actually, they're just kind of machines driven by their genes. They're just kind of performing very complicated programs that their genes tell them to do. And what we actually have begun to now see is that there's this deep intelligence in all of nature, not just in other very high-functioning mammals. It doesn't take too much to look at how elephants, you know, will communicate with each other over thousands of miles through infrasound, or even mourn the bones of their ancestors in ceremonies. Of course, it becomes almost self-evident that there's a deep intelligence there. But even trees that we think of as this kind of things that don't do anything, like, you know, when someone's in a coma, we say they're a vegetable, right? But trees, it turns out, have deep intelligence. They actually have about up to 15 or 20 different senses, not just our ways of feeling and seeing and hearing things, which they have, but also all these other ways of connecting with their environment. And they respond intentionally and purposively to what happens around them. And they'll even communicate with each other. So, like, this great biologist actually... Pettis, in the Northwest, I think, not far from where you are, Suzanne Simard, who has studied how trees communicate through the intricate fungal network underground, and she calls it the wood wide web. And they don't just communicate information to other trees within the forest, they'll even trade resources. They'll allocate resources from the big, healthiest, strongest mother trees to younger trees on the periphery when they're needed. Just amazing intelligence. And then, just to go one level further, even a single cell, absolutely, you know, invisible to the naked eye. We have about 40 trillion cells in each of our bodies. Every single cell also has an intelligence that even our most advanced AI can't even rival. It can sense, it has different, like up to 1,000 different ways in which it's relating to the environment all at the same time. It holds, like, sometimes millions of different proteins that is continually organizing and reorganizing. It communicates with the other cells around it. And together, cells will actually make decisions in a self-organized manner. This is the intelligence that we humans also share with all of life. And once we begin to feel into it, then it's impossible not to feel so much more connected with life on Earth.
Well, Jeremy, you're making me feel a whole lot better, because we had to cut down a few of our Monterey pines, and I went up to them and apologized.
Yeah.
I just thought that there is some intelligence there.
Yes.
And Pettis, I'll kick it to you after the break. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is the web of meaning. If you have ideas for the show, you may reach Pettis or me by emailing info@KSQD.org. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Thank you, Jill. And in an interesting bit of synchronicity, if you're enjoying tonight's edition of Be Bold America, I invite you to stay tuned at 6 o'clock at the end of the program for our following program, Reflections on Buddhism, a monthly look at how the principles and practices of Buddhism relate to everyday life with local host Venerable Tenzin, a local Buddhist nun and teacher. In today's edition, Western culture emphasizes independence and the individual, yet in reality, we are all connected and dependent on each other for our very survival. Charles Darwin's work on evolution revealed that cooperation is, in fact, the defining factor of successful species. In this month's edition of Reflections on Buddhism, We have a wide-ranging conversation, and you'll learn how the Buddhist principle of interdependence can help inform many of the most pressing issues we face today. That's coming up at 6 right here on Case Creed, right after Be Bold America, and we return now to Jill and Pettis and Jeremy.
Now back to our bold and impressive guest, award-winning author Jeremy Lent. Jeremy is an author and speaker whose work investigates the underlying causes of our civilization's existential crisis and explores pathways toward a life-affirming future. And we're discussing his new book, The Web of Meaning. Learn more about Jeremy at jeremylent.com. Pettis?
Thanks, Jill. Jeremy, I'd like to begin to take a look at human beings in a little bit different way. You speak about the I and the self and the dance that happens between them. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, for sure. So I think it might be helpful for people who don't know the book to understand that the book itself actually is structured according to some of the biggest questions that all of us humans ask at some point in our lives, like, who am I? Where am I? What am I? You know, how should I live? Or even, why am I? And so in that first section of the book, I actually look at that question, who am I? And one of the ways in which we can explore that is actually through recognizing that in some sort of strange way, each of us is kind of a little bit like a split personality. That, and to get your question, we have like an I and a self. And that's kind of hard to get a handle around until we start thinking about just kind of the way we speak about ourselves in normal language. Like, so, I mean, imagine I'm talking to you about like a job that I've recently been on, and I might say to you something like, I was really pushing myself too hard, and I was really angry with myself that I didn't tell the boss I'm not going to do that, and now I've left that job, and now I feel more at peace with myself. And you know what I'm talking about, but if you think about what I just said, it's like there's two of me. There's I, and I'm pushing myself, and who's the self I'm pushing? And you begin to realize then there is this kind of split going on. And that is what I explore, that actually this is something that cognitive linguistic experts have uncovered in recent decades. And it points us to a deep understanding of the human mind. That, you know, when I was talking before about Descartes saying, I think, therefore I am, and all that kind of stuff, that there is this part of us as human beings that has this I, that does say, that is aware of itself, and says, well, I think this about myself, and all this kind of stuff. And the self is more like that part of us that connects with all that animate intelligence out there, with all other living beings. It's that part of us that might, kind of lives moment to moment, it says, you know, I'm hungry, or I'm feeling sad, or like all the different things. Or at one moment we might feel angry, in which case we have to exercise self-control, right? Otherwise we don't want to be hitting the person we're angry with or whatever. So the I has to get control of the self to not sort of hit out. And so there's this complex relationship that the I and the self have. And I love that this announcement about this show that's about to come on about Buddhism and interdependence, because actually one of the ways that we can learn for that I and the self to harmonize with each other more is through some of those practices like mindfulness meditation, for example, where we get to recognize how the I is making stories always about the self. And by recognizing that, we can actually harmonize that, what I call the most important relationship in your life, which is the one between you and yourself.
That's beautifully stated. Let me follow up with some of your discussion about the ego, because I'm hoping we can get further down into how the Eastern philosophies kind of intertwine with science. But can you talk about the ego a little bit and how the ego tends to get in our way?
Yeah. And we're all obviously only too experienced with what that feels like. And we can think of the ego a little bit as almost a little bit like the membrane between us, the self, and the, sort of the rest of life out there, if you will. In just the same way that we were looking before about how organisms all have this animate intelligence, and all organisms have a membrane, which actually has it has to take in what's good and expel what's bad. And that membrane needs to be like sort of semi-permeable. If it's too stuck, then it won't be able to take in the good. And if it's too open, then it can just kind of get overwhelmed. So similarly, our ego we can think of as that sort of membrane that holds helps us to have identity. It's not that the ego itself is intrinsically a bad thing, but it's something that we build as we get grow up from childhood, and we also build it using the values and the constructions that we arrive from our parents, from friends around us, and from our culture. And so oftentimes the ego will lead us to maybe have views about ourselves that don't actually lead to that kind of harmonizing between the I and the self that actually can lead to true well-being and overcome that Buddhist notion of dukkha, that sense of something feeling like wrong, where the I is not satisfied with itself. So in many ways, I feel a lot of these practices towards well-being that I talk about in many parts of the book are about not getting rid of the ego. At times, you know, we can have like a moment of an altered state of consciousness where the ego can dissolve totally, and it can be terrifying, and it can also be incredibly enlightening and liberating. But we can't live our lives healthily without an ego on a day-to-day basis. But what we can do is treat the ego like that healthy membrane and not let it block ourselves from engaging with life in a flourishing way, but also use it to really kind of build a sense of our own true long-term flourishing with others.
Would you mind sharing the story of the archers and how their dispositions changed?
Yeah, sure. That's an ancient Taoist story, actually. It comes from this great Taoist sage called Chuangzi. And he talks about this Taoist notion of what's called Wu Wei, which basically it translates kind of simply as like effortless action. And that's almost like this action when either you can say there's no ego at all in the way, or else the ego has become so harmonized that we don't even realize its existence, almost like this kind of transparent and evanescent type of quality to it. And his story about the archers is he talks about these archers who had been in this contest. And at first, they would just kind of play for really kind of small stakes, you know, just kind of whoever got the best shot was the best person. And they were, you know, doing a fantastic job. And then somebody upped the ante and then said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a gold coin for whoever, like, gets the best shot. And all of a sudden, they lost their nerve and they did a terrible job hitting the targets because their ego had got in the way. They lost that Wu Wei, that sense of effortless action, because they started thinking, they got too goal-oriented, too attached to the outcome, rather than just being with that moment-to-moment present awareness of really the I being with the self.
That's a great example. Jill?
Yes, I have actually a follow-up on regarding the ego. Jeremy, I had a counselor many years ago that would explain when the ego totally takes over, the person doesn't have any compassion, humility, and empathy anymore. Mm-hmm. And I've since she's told me this many years ago, I have noticed this, that there are people that just don't seem to possess that it's all about them and the I. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it. And if we go back to that analogy I was saying before about the ego being like a membrane, it's as if imagine like an organism, and it keeps getting hit right from its infancy onwards. And so what's that membrane going to do? It's going to sort of form calluses, right, and scars. And as it does that, just like we know if we have a scar on our skin or whatever, it gets harder, and it gets like more numb, and it gets less sensitive and less able to be like permeable. It gets hardened up. And sadly, in our culture, which is so so filled with sort of kind of patriarchal violence on people as they grow up, it causes so many people to then have this hardened ego, which is the only way they can get through their difficult times in childhood and adolescence or whatever. So by the time they get to be a grown-up, it gets to be harder and harder for them to connect in those compassionate, loving ways with people outside that that ego, that membrane, because they got hurt too many times. And that causes like a numbness, if you will, which actually leads to a lot of these, the separations, the disconnection that people have that is really characteristic of our modern world today, sadly. Like people living these separate lives, so so caught up in their ego. And the ego itself actually gets so manifested in the advertising and the consumer culture that we're in, which actually kind of strengthens the ego. It tells people that that's what their reality really is their ego, how they look on their Instagram picture or whatever. So it's a, people actually get so caught up in the ego, they actually confuse their very identity with the ego rather than realizing it's just this membrane.
Wow. Well, you know, I remember a quote years ago that cynicism is a wound of the heart. And after listening to you, it sounds like the ego is a wound of the life. It makes me sad to think that people that ego took them over are so wounded.
Yeah, I think that's true. Or maybe just to restate it just a little bit, okay. Like that hardened ego, that hardened ego is the wound of life. Is it exactly right? Because again, I get concerned sometimes about some spiritual paths that make people feel that there's something wrong with having an ego at all. And that's not the case, actually. It's actually any healthy person needs to have basically a healthy ego, just like any organism needs to have a healthy membrane. And again, at times, it's amazing to, and a wonderful experience to just feel the ego totally dissolve. But then it kind of needs to come back in again. And as you know, one of the ways in which we can learn again from evolutionary biology is looking at how our ancestors evolved as human beings, like in nomadic hunter-gatherer bands. And they evolved to, it was important to them to be cared for and to be respected by the other people in that band. And there was nothing wrong about that. That led to healthy society and healthy organization. So as long as it's done within a place of healthy flourishing, that's a wonderful thing for every human being to celebrate in themselves. What happens is our society does the opposite. It actually makes people feel always comparing themselves to some, you know, super glamour model or some you know, unrealistically wonderful athlete or all these things. And so then we kind of feel wearily bad. And our whole sort of consumer society is about status orientation. So it's kind of designed to make us get so much caught in the ego that we forget that it's just one aspect of a healthy life.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. In addition, if you'd like to be added to our news group, you may text Be Bold America to 22828. Text Be Bold America to 22828. And next is our Hightower commentary, and he's titled it, Can Corporate Profit and Morality Be Compatible? I'm your host, Jill Cody.
And you're listening to K-Squid, KSQD Santa Cruz.
Is corporate ethics an oxymoron? Do you have to be a jerk to be a successful CEO? Is exploitation the only path to profit? The good news is that many companies, big and small, in the food economy are blazing a different path through Wall Street's jungle of greed, demonstrating that money and morality can be compatible. Texas supermarket chain HEB, for example, has drawn an intense loyal customer base by 1. Investing in good wages and benefits for employees, 2. Showing up in such emergencies as pandemics, hurricanes, freezes to give essential supplies and hands-on help, and 3. Being an involved and supportive neighbor to the hundreds of unique communities it serves. Also, Maine Grains is relocalizing the business of milling grain by working with local farmers who had been abandoned by global grain marketers. They're producing flours from heritage grains, boosting the local economy in the process. Then there's Bob's Red Mill, which also mills its products from diverse natural grains, and it's 100% employee-owned. These are part of a rising business alternative to the selfish profiteering ethic of Fortune 500 titans. Called certified B corporations, they definitely exist to make a profit, but they're equally focused on having a positive social impact, prioritizing fair wages, environmental protections, and healthy communities as core elements of their missions, even making those goals legal requirements of their corporate charter. This is Jim Hightower saying Ben & Jerry's and New Belgium Brewery are just a couple more of some 3,800 other businesses now organized as B Corps. Though not pretending to be perfect, they're at least striving to be more than money grubbers, instead trying to contribute to the common good. For more information, go to bcorporation.net.
K-Squid listeners, I'm Todd Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with award-winning author Jeremy Lent, who has been described by Guardian journalist George Monbiot as one of the greatest thinkers of our age. And he's also the founder of the nonprofit Leology Institute and the author of The Web of Meaning. And Jeremy, I have a listener question, which is, when we're talking to myself, when I'm talking to myself, is that two separate beings?
I don't see it as two separate beings, but more that two separate like patterns of cognition within integrated and a coherent organism. In fact, in my book, I talk about this word that I'd love it to become more known in just mainstream understanding, which is, it's called an attractor. And what an attractor is, it basically just refers to the patterns in nature that are very it's like robust and resilient, but always changing too. So they're sort of patterns like we see, like the sort of patterns of the rings of tree growth, or the patterns of clouds, or any kind of patterns that can be sort of cohered, but also are always flexible and changing. And it's as if we have in our consciousness these two different attractors of consciousness, the I, which is always kind of doing its thing, and the self, which it changes actually more frequently. But to get to what I call a truly integrated consciousness requires embracing both of those sort of patterns within us and realizing that they can both be loved. It's not like one's better and one's worse, but we can recognize that we're all part of this coherent organism. And just the same way we have a mind and we have a body, and the mind is really part of the body, and the body actually is what leads to and manifests the mind. And then we can actually expand that out and realize that we're not separate. Even though we think of ourselves as separate organisms or separate entities, we only exist as part of communities. And these communities only exist as part of larger communities and part of actually all like greater ecosystems and part of Gaia. So our very identity is not as fixed as what we're basically told in our more sort of mainstream way of thinking. But recognizing that it's all these elements at the same time is a way to lead to a more integrated way of being with ourselves. So that's how I sort of look at the I and the self being separate, but part of a coherent whole.
Thank you. Pettis?
Jeremy, could you talk a little bit about how we develop enough consciousness or awareness to re-engage with the natural world? You know, what sort of transitions do we have to make within ourselves so that we begin to become a bit more open to the idea that there are other ways of looking at the world? You touched a little bit on it when you started to talk about Native perspectives, Native American perspectives. So how do we begin to make that shift so that we can become more one with the surrounding world?
Yes, well, I think the far and away the most effective way to do it is to actually try as much as we can to actually give ourselves more time embedded in that natural world, which obviously, if we're fortunate enough to be able to for that to be available to us, to go and spend time just hiking in whatever land is around us. But then when we do get to be in the sort of non-urban world like that, there's also the way of doing it. There's this kind of lovely Japanese notion called forest bathing, which talks about the not just sort of going into the forest, but opening all your senses up to actually communing with what is there around you. So, you know, so what we're talking about then is not just sort of going for a hike and then thinking about the next job you've got to do and thinking about that conversation you just had with so-and-so and, you know, and maybe putting your earphones on and listening to your favorite music, but the opposite of that, actually giving yourself to what you hear and being attentive to what's around and just noticing when there's a bird flying around or noticing what a particular tree feels like, almost like being open as if all these sentient beings around us are actually wanting to communicate with us and just feeling into their energies and who they are as beings. And that leads before long to a completely different way of recognizing this incredible richness of life all around us. And of course, once you begin to feel into that, what's really needed is to go through some of the more troubling aspects of recognizing how much of that richness in life and all in the earth around us is being destroyed by this kind of growth-based corporate capitalism, and how we have to like shift what's going on because life itself is under attack from what our global society is doing to it right now.
Well, you're leading right into a question that I had for you, Jeremy, which was this week the UN released the report stating that it's code red for humanity. And in your book, you talk about something that the poet Aurora Levins Morales wrote, which was, defend the world in which we win as if it were your child. It is your child. Mm-hmm. Defend it as if it were your lover. It is your lover. Mm-hmm. How do we integrate? Do we have time to integrate our worldviews? And what were your thoughts when you heard about the UN report stating that it's code red for humanity?
Yes, well, because I've been personally so embedded in this, looking at the reality of the climate breakdown we're facing right now, it wasn't that there was anything in the report itself that gave me cause for surprise, but it was more than anything, like, finally, you know, the message is getting out. And one of the first times I've seen in a long time when the actual reality of this kind of climate breakdown we're facing actually hit the front page of most newspapers and actually got talked about in the media, because most of the time the media does everything it can to avoid talking about something that's not like selling, it's the, you know, the selling the eyeballs and the advertising, or whatever. So I feel it's critically important for us to be aware of what's going on. And I feel that there's kind of two things that are equally necessary. One is to really open our hearts and souls and minds up to this reality that all these climate catastrophes that we've been experiencing are only going to get worse, and that for many people who don't have the support that we have in the global north, most of humanity living in the global south, the disasters will be far, far more traumatic, and that for many ecosystems, the disasters are already happening and they're getting worse, and we have to recognize that. And that's hard. And oftentimes we need to turn to others because it's too difficult to even feel into that ourselves, just within our own being. And at the same time, we have to recognize that there is so much that is being done and can be done to turn this around. But the stuff that needs to be done to turn it around, even that is still not really being talked about that much in the main media. It's not just about investing in renewables or just about, getting sort of more adaptation going to deal with how we respond to forest fires or whatever. We actually have to change the very underpinnings of our society. And our society right now is based, it's structured on this growth-based global capitalism. The very essence of it is to exploit natural, it's to see the natural living earth as a resource and to exploit those natural, quote, resources as fast, as aggressively as possible. And even when new technologies come up, the capitalist system then finds a way to take advantage of that to exploit things even more. We had something like Bitcoin, which was meant to be something that could be a positive development for humanity. And then you get this crazy thing where people develop these massive Bitcoin farms using massive amounts of energy just to mine more Bitcoin so they can make a mint out of this new technology. So we have to change the underlying system itself. And something that I find that I want to really draw people's attention to is that even within this IPCC report, these scientists have done this incredibly complex and rigorous job of modeling these different scenarios, looking out decades ahead up to the middle of the century and to the end of the century of what would a 1.5 require, or what would a 2 degrees C rise in temperature look like, and all this kind of stuff. And in all these scenarios, they have this assumption that we have to like invest in these basically these magical technologies to find ways to bring tens of billions of tons of carbon, some new technology like to bring it down, otherwise we don't get to this net zero. But none of those scenarios even consider a scenario of actually gradually reducing the gross domestic product of the globe as a whole, actually bringing down the rate of consumption and production that is causing these problems in the first place. And the very fact that that's not even considered in this scenario shows in a way how we have to shift the very basics of how we are thinking about our society and our economy.
Pettis, I'm thinking we should break now because we need time on the other side for more discussion. So you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Want a friend to hear this program? They can hear it for free on the KSQD website or download it wherever they get their podcasts, such as Apple, Google, and Spotify. I'm your host.
Oops, thanks, Jill. Cut you off there at the end. I'm Howard Feldstein, the program director here, and I invite you to tune in to K-Squid tomorrow in this time slot, 5 to 6. We have our weekday program, Talk of the Bay, Monday through Fridays. How can our community support at-risk young people? And how can those young people support our community? Monday on Talk of the Bay, Suki Wessling is your host, and she speaks with Amanda Gambin, who runs the Youth Action Network. In the past year, the organization has shifted away from a focus on youth violence to a more proactive focus on youth empowerment and leadership. Suki and Amanda will be joined by some of the youth leaders who are part of the network. That's Monday at 5, again, right here on KSQD at 90.7 FM and ksqd.org. And a reminder to stay tuned after this program, Be Bold America, coming up in 15 minutes at 6 o'clock. We have Reflections on Buddhism and a discussion of many of the same themes that you're hearing now on Be Bold America. Back to you, Jill.
Well, today our topic is The Web of Meaning, and we're speaking with award-winning author Jeremy Lindt. Jeremy is an author and speaker whose work investigates the underlying causes of our civilization's existential crisis and explores pathways toward a life-affirming future. Learn more about Jeremy's books and his institute at jeremylindt.com. So in this last quarter hour, one of the things that we do try to do on this program is talk about creating a meaningful life and the principles that we live by and our keep, stop, starts. And Jeremy, I wanted you to know that Pettis and I taught a class, I don't know, it was 20 years ago, called Creating a Meaningful Life to hundreds of university students. So this topic has been a passion of ours for many years. Mm-hmm. Actually, a portion of the class was dedicated to Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences and Csikszentmihalyi's flow. So please tell us your search for a meaningful life and your observation that one's personal search for meaning cannot be isolated from all that is going on in the world around us.
Yeah, thank you for asking that question in such a profound way. And that was that point you just said at the end, that our own sense of meaning cannot be isolated from the rest of all life around us, is really what the web of meaning is all about, what that title is all about. And it was something that I came to personally just only after years of my own exploration. It wasn't obvious to me because it's certainly not what our mainstream culture tells us. And I went through a period of my life some years back now, like 15 plus years ago, when the things I'd built my life around kind of crashed around me. I'd started a very successful internet company that I took public, and what happened was that my wife at the time, she passed away some years back now, she got sick. I left the company too early. The company collapsed. And then my wife suffered cognitive decline, and I lost that deep connection. And it's as if everything I had was collapsed, and I wanted to make sure that whatever path I went on was truly meaningful. And so I went through this years of trying to put this jigsaw puzzle together or almost like peeling the onion of where did all these layers of meaning actually come from and what do other cultures tell us? And it was only after years of that that I began to realize that this deep connectivity meant that the meaning itself is actually a function of the connections between things. It doesn't come from some sort of God figure that sort of created the universe or whatever that is that, and that's the sort of holy source, and that there's no intrinsic meaning in our world or in us, but it has to come from outside or whatever. But it's actually arises. It's an emergent principle that arises from the connectedness of our being with all of stuff around us. So I mean, imagine if you think for a moment about times in your life when things felt meaningless, for example. If you think about that, you realize it was the times when you felt less connected with others. And when you think about what is in your life that feels the most meaningful, you'll realize that it actually is the one that does connect you with other people or other parts of life, or connects you with futures, with scenarios. But it's all about that connection. And once we see that, we get to realize that actually embracing that connection and actually fully embracing it is essentially what we can think of as love. We can actually sort of think of love itself as being just this realization and embrace of that connectedness of all things around us.
Jeremy, thank you so much for sharing that story. It was very powerful. Pettis?
Yeah, Jeremy, we're kind of closing in on the end, but I do have two questions that maybe if you're able to give us some short responses, we can get them in. Excuse me. The first one is, you talk about a rice experiment that you did, which I found fascinating, because you were speaking about how small things can have big impacts. So if you could talk about that, and then I'd like to come back and ask you about your New Zealand study.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So this rice experiment is one that actually comes towards the end of the book, where I'm looking at how the world seems sometimes like it's setting on this course for disaster, and sometimes it can feel it's so vast, and the things that are going bad are so huge that we can ask, well, what can either of us do? You know, like, and basically, my role in all this must be kind of irrelevant. And what this Rice study showed was so fascinating. It was actually a study done by physics researchers who were wanting to look at how avalanches occurred, in fact. And so they put this pile of rice together, and they saw, like, each time they dropped one little grain of rice on this big pile, sometimes, or most of the time, very little would happen, and then every now and then be this big avalanche. And it's kind of, that describes a little bit how earthquakes happen and lots of systems in nature. So one day I said, let me see what happens when I try it. So I did this whole thing and started to, like, drop little bits of rice on this pile one by one to see what would happen. But here's what was so interesting. I saw what the physicists said about the avalanches every now and then, but I noticed that after I dropped one or two of these bits of rice, and then I did nothing, but then a few seconds later, you'd see this movement in the pile as if the whole pile was alive. I was going, what's going on? And then I realized that what's actually happening is when you drop one of these grains of rice, it's actually having this tiny little effect on thousands of other little grains of rice in this inert pile, so that they then connect with other rice around them, so that places far away from where the rice dropped actually a few seconds later were getting affected by that first piece of rice dropping. And I realized, wow, if this happens in this inert pile of rice, how much truer is this for our entire human society, where each action we take, every thought, every, like, conversation we have is actually impacting people in ways that we can never really know, we can never predict, and we'll never know who then moves on from what we said or did to impact somebody else and then somebody else. And I'm so glad that the show after this one is actually on this Buddhist concept of interdependence or dependent origination, because that is this great insight that Buddhism has, which is how everything ultimately is dependent on everything else. And by the same token, when we look at all these disasters taking place, the climate and the ecological breakdown right now, we have a responsibility to realize that actually the impact, we, each of us, actually has an impact on the future that unfolds.
Jill, do we have time for one more question?
Yes, I think. Did you want to learn about the New Zealand study?
I would. Yeah. Because I think it's important work with our children. Mm. So, Jeremy, would you mind speaking about that study, please?
Oh, sure. Well, there was this, we were talking before about the I and the self. It leads to this question about kind of self-control, if you will, because one of the ways in which we sort of we think the I is meant to relate to the self is kind of to control the self. And it did turn out in this very long multi-decadal study in New Zealand that got done was to recognize that actually those children whose relationship between the I and the self was really more harmonized, and the I and the self could actually act together in a way that led to ultimately more so self-regulation, were the ones who much later on in life turned out to be more successful, happier, and had fewer problems with addiction, violence, crime, or anything like that. So it does really impact the way that we need to recognize how we have to give that nurturing to our children to give them the best chance in flourishing later in life.
Jill?
Keeping in line with our what listeners can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing, do you have any suggestions?
Well, sure. I'm very happy to share. In terms of keep doing, well, what I would just encourage everybody, and so anyone listening to this program is clearly doing this to a large extent already, is to be really curious, you know, to be open-minded, to recognize, to look at the ways in which some of our mainstream worldview ideas might close off possibilities, and to be curious as to different ways to look at the world in ways that may be more life-affirming or connected. So that's what I definitely encourage everybody to keep doing. In terms of stop doing, well, I think one of the issues that I know, Jill and Pettis, you look a lot at in this show, and that we're only too aware of every time we pick up the newspaper or go online, is this incredible, painful divisions that are happening in our society in the U.S. as well as all around the world, and political divisions, polarization. And it's very easy with things like climate breakdown to look at the people who are ignoring it or even causing it and see them as the enemy, and like these people that we just got to overcome and we got to beat them. And of course, they see us as the enemy too. And one of the, I think, the great learnings from this real recognition of deep interconnectedness is that seeing others as the enemy won't ever lead us to this path forward that we need to go to. That we can see things that get done that are wrong, and we can fight to put them right. I'm not saying we shouldn't like be there on the front lines to struggle for what's right, but recognize that the people who seem to be doing the things that are wrong are themselves suffering. They are themselves have been manipulated, have been given those hardened egos from early childhood onwards, and reach out to them with love, with connection, and try to have them open up to the possibilities of themselves approaching things in different ways. So what I would say to stop doing is stop othering anybody who we might not agree with. And then finally, in terms of what I would encourage people to start doing, is kind of what we've been touching on already in this program, to really start reconnecting with all of life around us, to recognize how deep is that connection with life, and to look for ways in which we can engage in turning our society around that could truly lead to a more life-affirming society, not just for humans to flourish, but for all life to regenerate and flourish along with us.
Well, one thing you were talking about under keep doing was curiosity. And I wanted to share, you know, we all know the idiom, curiosity killed the cat. Mm. But years ago, many years ago, I heard curiosity kills the cat, but satisfaction brought it back.
I love it.
So stay curious and keep learning, because that will be satisfying.
Yes.
You also close your book with a line, "What is the sacred and precious strand that you will weave?" Do you want to expand on that, please?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Well, you know, to some of what we've just been touching on the last few minutes is it can be very sort of overwhelming just to look at everything that's going on in the world and say, well, you know, this is happening elsewhere. This is like, what's going to happen to the climate? What's going to happen to the world? Oh, it's all kind of screwed up, or whatever we might look at and feel when we see these things going on.
And we have about 30 seconds, Jeremy.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. And just to recognize that each of us has a part to play in this web of meaning. Each of us does have this sacred strand that we can offer. And so this is the question each of us ultimately needs to ask, is look at, where can I weave something of true meaning into the world around me?
That's another great question for start doing, is asking yourself that question.
Yeah.
Well, it's that time when we've run out of time. I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, who's also KSQD's program director, Howard Feldstein. And once again, give a huge thank you to our bold and impressive guest, Jeremy Lint. To learn more about Jeremy and his books and his institute, visit jeremylint.com. We're so glad you had some time for us tonight, Jeremy.
Oh, it was just a delight to talk with you, Jill and Pettis. Thank you, both of you, so much.
Thank you.
It was very inspiring for us, I know. Next up on Be Bold America, we're going to discuss being Muslim behind the veil with returning guest lawyer and author Sumbul Ali Karamali. So join us on Sunday, August 29th at 5 p.m. to hear more of Demystifying Sharia and Sambal's perspective on the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban. Remember, you may listen free to any of our shows on the KSQD website or wherever you get your podcast. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Reflections on Buddhism. My name is Jill Cody.
And I'm Dr. Pettis Perry.
And thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start,